Hello, and welcome to Creation Matters with your host, Mike Riddle, the Tuesday edition of Hope Now Live. Mike is an author, teacher, and conference speaker, and is president of Christian Training and Development Services. Creation Matters is dedicated to the teaching of the biblical and scientific truths about God's creation. In the beginning, God created, and for by Him were all things created. And now here's your host of Creation Matters, Mike Riddle.
Did you know there are organizations in this country promoting censorship? And did you know it's affecting your children's right to a good, quality education? Welcome to Creation Matters, part of Hope Now Live, and we've got a great lineup for you here today. I have a guest with me today, Dr. David Menton. Welcome to the show, Dr. Menton. Can you hear us there, Dr. Menton? Do we have you on the show there? While we're waiting to get Dr. Menton here, I want to talk about something that just recently happened. Did you know there was a new skeleton found that they're claiming is a new missing link in our human ancestry? Just recently, a new skeleton of a tiny, tiny person, about 3 feet 4 inches tall, was found in the Indonesian island of Flores. They dubbed it Flores Man, or maybe possibly a woman. They're not sure what it was. But it's been declared to be a new species in the human evolution line, and they claimed it to be at least 18,000 years old. Now, why did they say this is a missing link? Well, it had a very small brain capacity, about 380 cubic centimeters, far smaller than humans today. But I want to let you know something. That's as it's been reported to us. You know, there's been many discrepancies in the past from reporting data to support evolution. For instance, a lot of you probably remember this guy called Piltdown Man. Almost promoted in our education system over 40 years as the fact of evolution, and it turned out to be a complete fraud. Then there was our own famous Nebraska Man, pictured at University of Nebraska, pictured in some textbooks as our missing link. Here was Nebraska Man, his full family and environment he lived in, turned out to be a pig's tooth. Then we had Neanderthals, which we talked about last week, were nothing more than modern human beings, probably had a better DNA structure, and you know, they had a bigger brain capacity than we did. And there's been many, many more, so we have to wait until we find out the real data, how big this brain really was. But let me give you something what they're not telling us. See, here's where we get into this problem called censorship. What they're not telling us in most journals and newspapers. See, they talk about this being in the human evolution line, but here's what they're not telling you. You know, the Indonesian scientists, and this is where they found the fossil in Indonesia, their own scientists are strongly refuting many of the sensational evolutionary claims about Flores Man. Here's a paleoanthropologist professor stating the skeleton is not a new species as claimed by these scientists, but simply a fossil of a modern human Homo sapiens that lived about, get this, 1,300 to 1,800 years ago. So they're not giving us all the information. Here's another gentleman, an anatomy professor, says that Flores Man was a microcephalic. Now, microcephaly is a disease that we still have around with us today, that causes the brain to not be as normally as big as we find in most humans. It can be quite a bit smaller. So it could be that could have been one of the problems with this man. And here's another one they haven't told us. Did you know the fossil skeleton they found was not fully fossilized, which raises serious doubt about being 18,000 years old? Scientists were even able to find soft tissue. They said they can carry it out DNA test. I can't wait to find out what those DNA tests tell us. But, you know, there's been very small people that have lived in very recent times, even in our time here. For instance, there was a black belt martial arts expert who starred in many motion pictures. He was only 2 feet 9 inches taller. That's smaller than Flores Man. The shortest married couple that we know of came from Brazil. When they were married, they were 3 feet tall. And the shortest ever actress was a lady by the name of Tamara, who stood 2 feet 7 inches tall as an adult. Folks, I don't believe we're being told all the information again. Why don't they tell us all the information? Why do they only tell us part of the information? Maybe they're afraid they don't have the information to support what they have, so they have to resort to other mechanisms called censorship. And speaking of censorship, how about this recent thing that's happened in Cobb County, Georgia, where the school board there wants to put a disclaimer in the biology textbooks? Now, before we get into this, I want to read you this disclaimer. And can you tell me anything that's gone wrong here? Anything that they said that's wrong? Now, here's the disclaimer they want to put in the textbooks. And they start this way. This textbook contains material on evolution. Well, that's not a problem. We know all the biology textbooks do. But here's what they go on to say in this disclaimer. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. Can anybody tell me anything wrong with this statement? Anything wrong with this statement? But yet, these professors and people have all gotten together and filed lawsuits. If you think you have anything wrong with this statement, give us a call at 206-374-8800. That's 206-374-8800 or toll-free 800-955-8200. Now, anybody that's really opposing this statement, and let me read it to you again. This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact. Contained regarding the origin of living things, this material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. I believe anybody that is against that statement is anti-education, anti-academic freedom, and guilty of promoting their own religious faith of evolution. And did you know evolution does not even qualify as a fact? It doesn't even qualify as a theory. It qualifies as an hypothesis, folks. See, a theory has to be able to predict, no exceptions, and it has to be repeatable. No one has been able to repeat evolution. Well, if they're with us today, we have a very, very special guest, Dr. Menton. Are you there, Dr. Menton?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine now. We had a little mix-up there. I probably hit the wrong button again.
Well, I'm here now. I'm listening to you and enjoying the program.
Well, Dr. Menton, would you give us a little bit of your background in this field?
Well, I did my undergraduate work with a double major in chemistry and biology at Minnesota State University in Mankato, Minnesota, and got my PhD in cell biology from Brown University, and spent a couple of years at Mayo Clinic in research in Rochester, Minnesota, and served for 34 years in the faculty of Washington University School of Medicine, and played a number of roles there, primarily research. I was the course master of histology, which is looking at the human body from the light microscopic down to the electron microscopic level. And I taught a bit of gross anatomy as well. So you might say the human body from the whole chunk down to the subcellular.
Now, is Brown University, is that a Christian university?
Well, historically, yes. Being one of the seven Ivy Leagues, all of which were Christian universities when they began, Brown was first established in Providence, Rhode Island, by Roger Williams, who built the first Baptist meeting house in America. And the university, like all of the other Ivy Leagues, was set up to basically train pastors and teachers for the Christian ministry. But it didn't take too many years before they started buying into universalism and what have you. And, of course, today, like all of the other colleges of its type, it's anything but a Christian school. It's, I guess we describe themselves as a secular school, although they still have a Department of Religious Studies. But
now, how many years have you been a professor of human anatomy?
Well, I've been on the faculty for 34 years, and I've been a professor for the last third of that, approximately, and have dissected lots of bodies and looked at lots of slides under microscopes during those years.
Now, let me ask you a real pointed question. Do you believe in creation?
Oh, absolutely. I believe that God has created us by the power of His Word. You know, Psalm 100, verse 3 tells us, "Know that the Lord, He is God. It is He who has made us and not we ourselves. We are His people and the sheep of His pasture." And I believe that. I believe it first because the Bible tells me that it is so. But I must say, during all the years that I was in science, having opportunities to look at biological systems, and particularly humans, the evidence for a creator was just quite simply overwhelming.
Now, you have more credentials in the academic field than high school teachers and more than most university professors. I want to ask you another very pointed question here. Do you believe in a literal six-day creation?
I'm asked that quite often, and I tell people sometimes I have a little trouble with six-day creation, and my trouble is this, for the life of me, I can't figure out why God would have dilly-dallied for six whole days to create.
I like that.
After all, a miracle doesn't take any time at all, does it, or it wouldn't be a miracle. It would just be working fast. But I believe God created in 6 days, just as Scripture says, and I think since it's a miracle, the issue of time isn't really relevant to the task, other than to just simply go by what the Bible says is true.
When we come back, we're going to take Brian from Port Orchard, and we're going to talk some more about Lucy and the Australopithecines, which Dr. Minton is what I would call an expert in that field. So when we come back, Brian from Orchard, and we're going to talk about Lucy and Australopithecines. Give us a call, 206-374-8800 or 800-955-8200. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Creation Matters. I'm your host, Mike Riddle, and today's topic is going to be Lucy and the Australopithecines. Do you have missing links in your family tree? And with me today is Dr. David Menton, a Ph.D. in cellular biology, and over 30 years as professor of human anatomy. And welcome again, Dr. Minton.
Well, good to be back.
And we have a caller on the line. I'd like to take that call. We have Brian. Welcome to the show here.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're doing just fine here.
So I guess you're doing Lucy in the Ground with Diamonds, huh?
You betcha.
The reason I called, not because I disagree with the overall premise, and I am in favor of stickers of that sort being put into textbooks, along with the broader topic that you're speaking about. The thing that bothers me is when the use of the word theory is taken as to imply something that's in doubt, when the fact is that no amount of evidence ever will elevate a theory beyond being a theory. A theory is a type of thing, not a level of confidence.
You're right. You start with a hypothesis, and you take your hypothesis eventually to a theory, then to a theorem where you apply some mathematics to it, and then you get to what we eventually call maybe a scientific law. But here's why I disqualify evolution as being a theory.
With which I agree, by the way.
Thank you. I do, too, because it is not a theory. A theory, when I've gone through many definitions in textbooks and science journals, they all use the word observable, and we have not observed evolution.
Well, it's got to be observable. Reproducible,
right.
Testable, falsifiable. None of these things can be done. I really like reading Kelly Hollowell. She's a very good writer, scientific writer,
yes,
and a Christian.
Yes.
And her take on this, and I think it's outstanding, is the best name for this thing that we're contemplating is a model. It should be called a model. It's the model of evolution. It's a proposed explanation of the way of things, and that's what a model does.
Well, thank you, Brian, for that. That's exactly the way I treat them both. I take the model of evolution and the model of creation. Thanks a lot for calling in, Brian.
Bye-bye.
Now, Dr. Minton, I look at all these textbooks, and we see Lucy and the Australopithecines throughout these textbooks. Would you tell us a little bit about who Lucy is and this fancy word Australopithecine and what that means?
Well, sometimes the names tell us quite a bit, lest anyone think that Lucy is human in any sense of the word. Her scientific name tells you otherwise. The name Australopithecus, first of all, Australo means southern. We see it in the Australian continent, which is certainly very southern. And Pithecus or Pithecine, wherever you see that word, does mean ape. So whenever the word Pithecus appears in the scientific name of an organism, you know that whatever else you might say about this creature, you are talking about an ape. And so Australopithecus means southern ape, if you will, and afarensis simply refers to the region in the northeastern Ethiopia where this particular specimen was found back in 1974 by Donald Johansson and other co-workers, and they were listening to the radio at the time. This was, think of it, back in 1974. The Beatles were big then. I don't know if it was a radio or record player, but in any event, they were hearing Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which, of course, was an acronym for LSD that was supposed to get by all of us old-timers who weren't hip to this. But it was called Lucy. Obviously, they believed just right off the bat that they were dealing with a female specimen. It now seems considerably more than likely that it wasn't female at all, it was male, which goes to show you how badly mistaken we can be in dealing with fossils. And nonetheless, Lucy was declared to be a almost certain ancestor of Homo sapiens, which would, of course, be modern man, and in fact, an ancestor of the genus Homo.
Now, I just want to break in here for just a moment. If your students or teachers are out there, you need to go get your textbook right now and look up Lucy, or the word Australopithecine, and that's what we're talking about, and give us a call. What's in your textbooks? And you can call us at 206-374-8800. That's 206-374-8800, or you can call toll-free 800-955-8200. Now, Dr. Menton, I've looked at these textbooks, and one of the textbooks I looked at says they found a near-complete fossil of Lucy. How much did they really find?
Well, Lucy, that particular specimen that we call Lucy, was about 40% complete, which may sound like a smallish collection of bones compared to 100%, but I can tell you, as primates go, it's pretty extraordinary to find that many bones together. There are so few primates in the fossil record. When you think about it, 95% of all fossils are marine invertebrates. 4% of the remaining 5% are plants. You have 1% of everything that includes all of the invertebrates, insects, what have you. And by the time you get down to bony creatures, you have a tiny fraction of 1%, and primates are a small fraction of that. So people were excited to find so many bones, and I might point out that within a year of finding this particular specimen, 13 other presumed to be similar specimens were found, and they're collectively referred to as the Hadar Australopithecines, because they were found in the Hadar desert region in Ethiopia. And these Hadar Australopithecines collectively sometimes are referred to as Lucy. You have to admit, it's a lot easier to just say the word Lucy than to say the word Australopithecus afarensis every time you
want
to mention. So I will sub the word Lucy in for Australopithecus afarensis, and I'll try to sort out when I mean the specific fossil and when I mean generally the Hadar Australopithecines. You know, the reason they even came to believe they were human, well, first of all, let's point out that there's a great deal of experimenter bias in the whole field of paleoanthropology. Obviously, the pressure to find an ancestor of man is great. If you look at a typical chart in a textbook of the evolutionary history of man and the modern apes, you find that according to evolutionary speculation, modern apes and men were supposed to have split off about 5 million years ago. And I don't accept any of these dates. I'm just simply quoting what the textbooks say. But if you follow the ascent from that first common ancestor, which, by the way, largely goes unnamed, they've begun to make a few stabs at what it might be, but this hypothetical common ancestor 5 million years ago, if you look at that point and then you look up to modern apes, you tend to find nothing. In other words, there are no ancestors indicated, even though the modern apes have presumably been evolving just as long as we have. And if you look at the ancestors of man, of course, there are all kinds of creatures that are plugged in there that are supposed to be presumed ancestors. And I think it really reveals that there really is no money or prestige in finding an ancestor of an ape. The real prestige is in finding an ancestor of man. And so whenever somebody finds a extinct primate in the fossil record, and they can judge based on its strata that it's found in that it must be old, that's an assumption, then, of course, the pressure to declare it to be a so-called hominid is quite great. And a hominid, by the way, is defined as either a man himself or a known non-human ancestor of man, non-human primate ancestor of man, or a collateral relative of man. By that, I mean an organism that kind of branched off along the way.
So if I called my wife a hominid, that would not be a good thing to do?
Well, I guess we're, according to this definition, all hominids. In fact, man is perhaps, in my view, the only known hominid. The other animals in the fossil record are either just other humans, or they're apes. In fact, if you think about it, they're really, assuming the Bible's true, there are three ways to make an ape man. You can take an ape fossil, and you can sort of attempt to upscale it into a human, and I believe this has been done in the case of Lucy or the Australopithecines in general. Or you can take a human skeleton, and you can try to find something about it that will permit you to downscale it as something less than a human. And, of course, that was done with Neanderthal man and other specimens, and you discussed that last week. And then there's what I call the true ape man. That's kind of an interesting situation. That's where you find a piece of a ape fossil in one location, and then many, many miles away, you might find a piece of a human fossil, and you put the two together and declare them to be one specimen. And that sort of thing has been too. It has been done. The most famous example, of course, being Piltdown Man.
We're going to take a break here in just a moment, and we're going to come back, and I'm going to ask you, Dr. Menton, one of the most key features about Lucy. Did she walk upright? Because when I read all these textbooks, they talk about Lucy walking upright, and we have a lot of lines open. If you'd like to talk to a leading expert in the field, give us a call at 206-374-8800, 206-374-8800, or toll-free 800-955-8200. And we'll be right back and find out, did Lucy really walk upright? Welcome back to Creation Matters. This is your host, Mike Riddle, and with me today is Dr. David Menton, Ph.D. in Cell Biology and Professor of Human Anatomy. And if you'd like to ask him a question on Lucy and the Australopithecines, give us a call at 206-374-8800 or toll-free 800-955-8200. And stay listening, because at the end of this show, we're going to tell you how to get a DVD all about Origin of Humans, and it has an interview with Dr. David Menton on there. Well, Dr. Menton, we left off with a very important question, because one of the keys I see in the textbooks and what they teach in the schools is Lucy could walk upright, and that's a major factor in going from an ape-like creature to human. And all these textbooks will go right out and say Lucy could walk upright. Would you tell us something about that?
Well, that's right, and that's the reason people are probably more excited about Lucy than any other specimen, because here's a creature that clearly is not human, and yet it's argued we have compelling evidence that this creature walked essentially just like you and I do. And I might say that human bipedality is unique. There is absolutely no animal alive today that has a gait that walks as we walk. There are a number of animals that can walk on two legs. Birds do it all the time. My dog can even do it for a short distance. But human bipedality, with that distinctive gait, with that distinctively shaped foot and push off as we as our foot hits the ground and we push off, there is no other organism that walks like that. And to walk that way requires some very special anatomical features, some of which people claim Lucy has. One of the areas we look for happens to be the knee joint. When we walk, our feet are fairly close together. If you stand up, say at attention, you note your feet essentially touch one another. And you might expect that if your legs were perfectly straight, your feet ought to be about as far apart as your hips are, which would mean women who have a little broader hip yet would have feet that are even further apart, at least 8-10 inches apart.
So you're saying we're knock-kneed.
And so, yeah, we humans are knock-kneed. Our femurs converge at our knee, and between the femur and the tibia, that's basically the upper leg above the knee and the lower leg below the knee. That junction forms an angle, and that angle's called the carrying angle, or sometimes the valgus. And in the case of humans, it's about an 8-degree angle is measured on the outside of the limb. And it turns out Lucy has about a 15-degree angle of valgus. And so, of course, that got people very excited, because humans have that, and here's an ape that has an even higher degree. It's important for walking, because if you don't have your weight over your feet, it forces you to waddle from side to side. If you think of most apes walking, they swing their upper body from left to right to keep their weight planted over the foot that is on the ground, and they need to do that because their feet are so far apart.
Isn't that the way football players run?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons they have to walk that way. Now, here's an ape that has a high carrying angle, and that first might appear to be, you know, extremely suggestive of being able to walk as we walk. However, the question we need to ask, are there any living apes that have the same kind of a carrying angle as we do? And the answer is yes. Two examples will suffice here. The orangutan and the spider monkey have approximately 8-degree carrying angles, just as we do. The question then is, well, if modern apes that nobody suggests are turning into humans or are partly human, if they have it, then does the presence of such a carrying angle in a fossil prove anything? We might further ask, what is the function of a carrying angle in a creature that's clearly not human, like an orangutan or spider monkey? And it appears that arboreal apes, those that live in trees, have such a carrying angle, and of course it keeps their weight under their feet, and walking on a limb in a tree is rather like walking on a tight wire, and if ever there's an occasion for keeping your feet together, that would be it, wouldn't it? So here's a place where the evidence is simply not very compelling, because we have living animals that have carrying angles like that. Perhaps a better line of evidence would be the pelvis. To walk the way we do requires a pelvis that has a certain shape. The pelvis is basically the hip bones, you know, the left and right, and the sacrum that kind of is between the two of them. That forms a ring that your two legs attach to. And in the case of humans, the iliac blades, those are the bones you feel just under your belt. If you kind of take your thumb and feel along your side, just above your belt, that edge there is the iliac blade. That blade runs front to back in humans. Think of a steering yoke on an airplane. You know, the handles are kind of vertical there. In the case of apes, it sticks out sort of like a fan left and right. Instead of being forward, it flares. And the reason this is important is there's a certain muscle that attaches to that iliac blade called the gluteus medius, and that goes down to that upper leg bone, the femur. And when we lift our left leg, for example, that gluteus medius on the right side has to contract to keep our hip from falling on the left side. I know this is kind of difficult to explain on radio, but the long and short of it is you can look at the pelvis and tell. What kind of pelvis does Lucy have? Well, she has a typically ape pelvis. In fact, if you were to simply ask this question, which animal alive today does Lucy most closely resemble by far? It would be the living chimp. The pygmy chimp. It's a small animal. Lucy's about 3.5 feet tall, and it would most resemble a pygmy chimp. Every part of its anatomy, or almost every part, not that it would be identical to a pygmy chimp, it's clearly a different species, but that would be the animal it most closely resembles. You know, the most compelling evidence that the evolutionist brings forth to show that Lucy walked upright are really the footprints that were discovered 2 years before Lucy was discovered. Mary Leakey saw footprints in Latoli, Tanzania. This is about 1,000 miles away, by the way, from where Lucy was found. And there she found a 73-foot-long trail of footprints that had been fossilized into volcanic ash. It consists of about 20 footprints from a older individual, probably a 10-year-old person, and about 27 from a somewhat smaller individual. And what's really extraordinary is that each of the smaller footprints has yet a tinier set of footprints on top of them. It's as if a child, a third person, a child in this case, a very young child, was running along, greatly extending its stride in order to be able to step in each of the footprints of its older sibling. The most extraordinary thing of all, however, is when you look at these footprints, which, by the way, according to evolutionists, are supposed to be nearly 4 million years old. When you look at these footprints, they are virtually identical to the footprints that would be made by a habitually unshod modern human. By that, I mean, if you don't wear shoes, your toes take a little more relaxed position. People who wear those little pointy-toed, spiky shoes, their toes get all scrunchled up, and their footprint's going to look different than somebody who has been wearing moccasins or who goes without shoes. And so these footprints are absolutely identical, and there's no ape that has footprints like that, and there have been extensive studies on the feet of the hater Australopithecines, and it's quite clear the feet are, again, very much like you'd expect from a chimp. They're heavily muscled, long curved toes, no similarity to the human foot, no way on earth that the hater Australopithecines like Lucy could ever have made those footprints. But the footprints that Mary Leakey found are clearly those of an individual with feet identical to modern man who walked in a way identical to modern man. You might ask, why don't they then just assume that these footprints were made by Homo sapiens? And I actually had the chutzpah to ask Dr. Mary Leakey that at a reception after a lecture she had given, and in that tone of voice that the British reserved for the colonists, she said, "Oh, but surely you must know there were no humans around 4 million years ago." So you see, again, the bias the observer brings to the issue completely excludes the most obvious possibility, and that is human beings made these footprints.
Now, Dr. Mann, you've hit a really good point here, and it goes right back to one of the opening things we did in Cobb County where they're trying to put that disclaimer there. Did you know that's what they don't want students asking? They don't want students asking questions about evolution. They're trying to keep that out of the classroom. They don't want evolution challenged.
You know, Mike, I've had so much fun. I've gone into the classrooms of public high schools and advanced biology classes, and I've just simply brought in museum-quality replicas of ape skulls, human skulls, various presumed hominids, and just teach a little human anatomy and tell students what the difference is between an ape and a human, and then let the students decide for themselves. And students really like to take a critical approach to science, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the only approach one should ever adopt.
Well, we have a caller here now, and you've got somebody who wants to ask you a question. John from Bellevue, you have a question about Lucy.
Yes. In the anatomy that I studied, that the upright creatures, the spinal cord, should go through the bottom of the skull in order to be walking upright, and through the back of the skull if it's upright, like apes. Is there any evidence that of a skull opening on Lucy?
Yeah, Lucy. The Lucy specimen doesn't have much of the skull available. The whole top, you might say, 7/8 is missing. You really just have sort of the base of the skull and the lower jaw, and even the base is pretty fragmented. Yeah, I don't know if you can make a compelling argument. You're talking about the foramen magnum, which is the hole that the
right.
spinal cord goes through, and animals that walk with a very, very slumped posture would tend to have a foramen magnum more towards the rear, and those that are more upright towards the center. I can't really give you specific information on that. I know that virtually everything that's been examined, including even recently the semicircular canals, they've been able to image using computer tomography, are clearly not those of a biped that walks upright. The upper limbs, for example, of Lucy are very long, and recently they've discovered that all of these creatures, the Australopithecines in general, including the group that Lucy belongs to, have locking wrists, and so were clearly knuckle walkers. They would have walked with what we would call the outside of our arm forward, so our knuckles would point forward if we walked that way.
Well, let's come back here in just a moment. We're going to need to go to take a break. And if you think this is good information, wait till we come back from break. We have one of the most incredible things that has been done, and it was actually shown on PBS. And Dr. Minton's going to describe this most incredible thing. And, you know, he's going to talk about an actual replica of Lucy that they have in one of our famous museums. And if you have any calls, call us at 206-374-8800 or toll free 800-955-8200 and go get your textbooks. This is great stuff, folks. Come back and see us in about 4 minutes. Welcome back to Creation Matters, and with me here is Dr. David Menton, Professor of Human Anatomy. And folks, from what you've heard so far today, if you believe in human evolution, guess what? You've been taught wrong. And folks, if you're out there teaching human evolution, you need to think critically. Are you teaching real science, or maybe we need to reorder our textbooks to get the real science in there? And Dr. Menton, I mentioned before we went on the break here that I wanted to talk to you about some very incredible data that we discovered. It was actually shown on PBS. We didn't discover it. They actually showed it on PBS. Something about the pelvic bone, when they originally found the pelvic bone for this Lucy creature. What did they find, and what did they do to make it look like evolution?
Well, first of all, I think I've already mentioned that the pelvis is important because the pelvis tells us a lot about the way an organism walks. If you're going to walk like as humans do, and you're going to keep the hip from collapsing on the side that you raise a foot, so when I raise my left foot, the left hip collapses, I raise the right foot, the right hip collapses, that's prevented by a muscle that's on the side opposite the foot you're lifting. And that muscle is the gluteus medius. It attaches to what we call the iliac blade. That's that blade you feel under your belt just along the side. You can put your thumb there and feel it. In humans, it goes front to back, looks like a yoke on an airplane. In apes, it dishes out. Probably the most thorough study of the, not just the pelvis, but all of the bones that have been found of the hater australopithecines was published by Stern and Sussman in the American Journal of Physical Anthropology. People are interested in looking this up. It's volume 60. Starting on page 279, a very large article. And in this article, they concluded that the fact that the anterior portion of the iliac blade faces laterally in humans, that is the outer, it goes front to back, but the surface faces laterally, but not in chimps is obvious. And then they say the marked resemblance of the hater australopithecines to the chimpanzee is equally obvious. It suggests to us the mechanism of lateral pelvic balance during bipedalism was closer to that of apes than in humans. And this really has been a problem for evolutionists because they insist that those footprints found 1,000 miles away from Lucy in Tanzania, that those footprints were made by an organism like Lucy. Now, Mary Leakey, who discovered them, is quite sure herself that they weren't formed by Lucy. So here's Johansson insisting, yes, they were. Mary Leakey says, no, they weren't. Well, we know the feet could have made those footprints. The question is, could Lucy's pelvis have supported walking like that? And the answer is no. It flares out as a typical ape pelvis. It doesn't have the iliac blades going front to back as it is in humans. So there was just a really extraordinary program on our favorite programs, you know, or on public television, aren't they? And it's the PBS Nova series. They had a series called In Search of Human Origins. And in episode one, this is back in 1994, they show an anthropologist, in fact, he's the chairman of anthropology at Kent State University, Dr. Owen Lovejoy, solving the problem of Lucy's pesky ape-like pelvis. What he did is he had a plaster cast. He didn't work with the original, obviously. When you hear what he did, you'll understand. He didn't work with the original specimens. He took a plaster sort of cast of Lucy's pelvis, showed commented that it was all wrong to be able to walk as a human does. It's way too ape-like. But then he insists that it must have been crushed. They even suggest that a deer stepped on it. At least they show a movie of a deer stepping on the pelvis, crunch, you know. So it was broken in pieces, and he said, of course, his job was to put it back together the way it originally was. He then breaks out a Dremel tool and proceeds to grind away on that thing. I mean, you can see parts flying all the way across the room. He's not just sawing, he's actually removing large pieces of what would have been the fossilized bone, in this case, a cast.
That's incredible.
He then reassembles it together, and by the way, he said that it fit too well. This is a direct quote. He said it fit too well in the original specimen. So when he got done with his Dremel tool, I guarantee he solved that problem. It didn't fit too well. In fact, he said it fit too well. It was anatomically impossible.
Well, this, Dr. Mann, we're going to have to stop you there. We're almost out of time. Is it possible you could come back next week?
Well, if I'm going to be in town next week, I would like very much to continue with this or anything else that might be of interest to you.
Because with your background and credibility, we'd just love to have you back on and do some more teaching, because I know there's many people out there who want to hear this teaching. And don't go away, because I promise you we're going to show you how to get a video and DVD with Dr. Minton on it. But I first want to thank our sponsors who are helping us sponsor this radio show, Hanson Chiropractic, wonderful people over there, Dr. Mary and Dr. Dan, great people. Believing in creation, and also the local creation group, CAPS, Creation Association Puget Sound, good group to offer some information. But you know, it takes financial support to continue our teaching on the radio and to developing new materials for homeschools and Bible studies and Sunday schools. We would like to invite you to partner with us with your prayers and financial support. And you know, you can do that by giving us a call at 425-269-3196. Give us a call at 425-269-3196 or visit our website, creationmatters.org. And you know, if you go right now, and we have many materials out there, if you order our special deal, our Origin of Life Equipping Course, that's for $19. That's 3 hours of video teaching, student manual, and instructor manual. If you go out there and order that within the next 3 days, we'll give you a free DVD, an $18 value with that. It has not only a whole lecture on the origin of humans, but Dr. Menton on there talking about different parts. So give us a call, 425-269-3196 or creationmatters.org. Thank you all, and God bless you. In the beginning, God created.
Creation Matters with your host, Mike Riddle, the Tuesday edition of Hope Now Live. If you'd like more information on today's topic or information about Christian training and development services, simply call 425-269-3196. That's 425-269-3196. Or go to the website creationmatters.org. That's creationmatters.org. And click on the KGNW radio box. Join us next Tuesday at 6 when we'll discover and discuss the truth that for by Him all things were created. That's all right here next week on Creation Matters, the Tuesday edition of Hope Now Live.